I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening. That would be Rich B. from Claremont. All right.
My name is Rich, and I am an alcoholic. And life is full of surprises. First of all, I was asked on Thursday if I was going to be at this meeting, and I said, no, I won't be able to make it because my wife and I have an engagement where we're going to be at a birthday party. It's a 70-year birthday party for a friend, and Jeannie reported to me this afternoon that she looked at the invitation, and that's tomorrow at 5, not today. So, oh, good, we get to come to the meeting tonight. And I came to the meeting tonight to listen. And thank you, Larry. life is full of surprises. I thought when I was trying to adjust to the idea that that I'll be speaking tonight at one of the roundups a few years back there was a speaker that that said that he was traveling out to be speaker at a meeting and his plane was delayed and missed the connection and then he got on the next plane and the guy that he was sitting next to asked him where he was going and did he miss his connection too and he said that he was going to be a speaker at a meeting and he may or may not make it. And the guy said, well, why, you should be a lot more upset and nervous than you are. And the guy said, well, there's probably going to be about 3,000 or 4,000 people at that meeting and any one of them could give the talk. And so here you go. I am an alcoholic. I'll probably I will die an alcoholic. But my goal is to get there to the end of my life as a sober alcoholic. And what my sponsor said more than once is we don't know if we've succeeded until we suck in our last breath, and it's a sober breath. And that's what I'm working towards. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My mom and dad both drank. They weren't in my memory. They weren't drinking alcoholically as when we were growing up. And I can say that I had a good childhood. But the fact is, you probably, some of you have for sure have heard this before, but if you shake the family tree, bottles fall out. An early memory I have is of taking trips from the Bay Area. That's where I grew up on the peninsula, and we'd drive over to Santa Cruz where my grandparents live on my mom's side, and it was always a toss up as to whether we would stay there for the weekend or turn right around and come back, because if grandma started drinking, it was going to be bad. And often it was maybe we made it to sitting down for dinner, but we didn't get to finish dinner and off we'd go. I got to sample drinks off of my grandparents and my aunts and great aunts drinks, and I liked that. I remember the first time that I got that feeling that we all know, and I know I was probably around 5 years old because we had just moved into the house that I was going to be in and all the way through my school years, and my parents asked me to join them and my brother in decorating the Christmas tree, and I was shocked. I thought Santa Claus brought the Christmas tree. You know, I was, you know, kids today get it a lot earlier than I did, but, and I think they knew I was going to be shocked, and what they did was, they let, me and my brother, drink, some of those little after dinner drinks, cream de mint or cream de cocoa, something like that. And I don't remember that there was a limit. And I got really, really happy, and I really didn't care anymore that Santa Claus didn't bring the tree. I woke up the next day, and there were no consequences. I hear a lot of people say about how they drank, they got sick, and, you know, but still couldn't wait to do it again. I was fine, and I couldn't wait to do it again. It was great. From that point on, I pursued getting as much to drink as I could get. Of course, when you can't buy your own, you have to resort to, not quite begging, but looking for the opportunities when they could come. And I remember helping myself to the liquor cabinet, I remember one time probably around seventh, eighth grade. Mom was back working part-time and I helped myself to the bottle that was the fullest, and that was scotch. And I drank enough of that to get really ripped. I had a piano lesson that afternoon. It was a long walk to get there, so that helped a little bit. But the piano teacher called me on it. She said, "You know, you just don't seem right today. What's going on?" And I had smoked a cigarette before I got there, and I said, "You know, I smoked, you know, and I'm feeling a little dizzy." And so, you know, that was the way that went. Fast forward. It took me about a week, at least 5 days, maybe a week, to get over my 21st birthday. You know, by then I was a daily drinker. As soon as I was able to buy my own, it was daily drinking. Not that I got drunk every day, but I drank every day, and many of those days I would get there. When I was getting to the last year of my of college, I got this invitation in the mail to go and get a physical for the draft, and all of a sudden I became really patriotic in another way, you know, like I ought to do something that is helpful for everybody, and there was a sign to join the Peace Corps at the school I was going to, so I looked into the Peace Corps real seriously, and in fact got to go into the Peace Corps. When I graduated, I got to go to Washington D.C. and did the deal in Georgetown, and that was the training. And I didn't see a lot of the sights in Georgetown, but I did find a lot of bars on M Street with some of our friends. And I got to go to Chile and lived for two years and 3 months in southern Chile. And if you're an up and coming alcoholic, Chile is a good place to go to. You know? They love to drink good wine, also not so good wine, but boy, it's cheap. And there was one thing that happened in that, and there's actually a couple of them, that tells me, you know, I was alcoholic, you know, then. Here's the deal. We get there, and we spend a couple of days in Santiago, and then they put us on a train, and we go south all the way to Valdivia. That's an all night and part of the morning deal. Get there, and southern Chile is like like our Northwest. It rains a lot, all the time. And it was raining when we got there. It was cold. I get to this boarding place where I'm going to be staying until I find my own place, and I look out the window and down to the street, and as the rain is coming down, it's cold inside the place too, and I'm feeling lonely, and I'm feeling lost, and tears start welling up, like I'm feeling low. What did I do to myself? And then my vision goes up to across the street and up the building across the street, and there's a sign on it, and it says Bodega de Vinos. Now, I had studied Spanish, and then we did Spanish practicing, and I know what Bodega de Vinos means. It means wine warehouse. What happened is, all of that sadness and moroseness and what have I done to myself, that all just went to the side, and I'm starting to think now, if that's a warehouse, can people from the public go in there and buy? Is my knowledge of Spanish, you know, well enough to pull off, a deal? And I was off on my plan, and I came back with a 5-liter jug of red wine in a wicker basket, and I had a big smile on my face, and there we go, you know. Another deal was, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but the image of Peace Corps is being out in the country and you know, helping the folks. And a bunch of students at the school that I was working at got together, and they were going to build a school out in the country. So my roommate and I, we joined them, and we go out there. And I lasted one night. I did not stay to do that. I had to go back and prepare classes because school was starting in a couple of months. And what I know now is, and it didn't take long in recovery to figure it out, I couldn't stay there because there was no booze. I had to get back into town. That was the way it was. That was when I was, about 22, 23 years old. Got back from the Peace Corps, got married, finished up some more school, got a job, have two wonderful boys. And my drinking just kept escalating and escalating. I was kind of moving up the ladder at work, but so was my drinking going up. And one experience there was in the office. I was actually working in Mexico at the time, in Tijuana. There was a plant that I worked at there, and somebody put the 20 questions on my desk. And I thought it was a joke, but now I know it was no joke, you know. People would ask me, why do you drink the way you drink, you know. And I would always answer, for me it was the truth, because I like it, you know. I was the guy that got to drive people home when they drank too much, you know. It wasn't me that had to. Now I know that's a sign there's a problem, you know. But when I got to drive my boss home and the plant manager from Ireland home from Tijuana, where we were doing tequila shots, you know, I was up there among the successful. I got to that place where I was in trouble, but I couldn't admit it. That was really what it came down to. I could still get to work pretty much on time. And by the afternoon I could be pretty productive. Always had to stop for a lunch break, and lunch break always included some beer. You know, that's a good healthy beverage. You know, it's not fattening like some of the other things. Doesn't rot your teeth. But it came down to where Monday mornings, I could not make it through the morning. I'd get to work, I'd go and check and see how I looked, and how much Visine do I need. And then, I would go and make the rounds so people knew I was there. I'd get into this little office. It was kind of like it was a cave almost. I started going up that ladder at work, and then it leveled off. And then I started having those, they call them lateral transfers, And that got me into that little office. And I'd sit in that little office and I'd start feeling like I was gonna pass out or shake apart, or I just had to get up and go. And I'd get in my car and I'd drive down to San Clemente Canyon, and I would park under one of those big oak trees, and I would get well enough to finish the morning, and I would make this deal with myself. Next Monday morning, I'm not gonna be down here getting well enough to go and finish the day, Next Monday morning would come. Guess where I'd be? Parked under the tree, getting well, making the same deal with myself. And, the best way to describe it is that, I was still carrying out the responsibilities, but I was close to dead inside, hanging on. And I don't know how long that would have gone on, but what happened is that God put together these people that I refer to as my beloved SWAT team. It started with my first wife. I lovingly refer to her as what's her name. My two boys, who I had a pretty good, pretty good relationship with, but it got way better in sobriety. And some friends, a couple of them came out from Phoenix, and their daughter was there, and the church minister's wife was there, and I think he was chicken and did not show up for this deal. Now, here's the way it went. I got invited to go and see a counselor with what's her name? Pat. Okay. Yeah. By the way, I love Pat. She saved my life. She was the ringleader. She put together this group of people, and I was going to go see a counselor with her on a Monday morning. She picked me up from work, and I was going to see the counselor with her about her problem with my drinking. And I described how I had been feeling, and I was going to go there really prepared to put something on the table. I was really going to cut back. That was what I was going to do. And we get there, and the nice counselor invites me in. I didn't even know where we were going. It turns out it was at the McDonald's Center. But don't forget, it's Monday morning. I'm just making it. And she invites me in, and then she says, let's go into this room where it's a little, quieter. And well, a little quieter. There was a bunch of people in there, and they were all prepared. And the message, anybody here been in an intervention? Yeah. They all had pretty much the same message. How much they love me, and what a nice guy I am. But what alcohol is doing to me and to our relationships. I know I got three gifts that day, and there may have been more. Call it God's grace, call it whatever you want, but I got enough open-mindedness to hear what they had to say without running away. Of course, I didn't have a getaway car either. That was arranged too. And I listened to all of that. And after each person talked, they always ended up with, and that's why we want you to go into treatment. I negotiated. Not about cutting back anymore, you know, because they weren't going to buy that. But this was the Monday before Easter, and I should be home at Easter. They wanted me to start right away, and I said, no, I should be with the family on Easter, and my head is going, and it's my job on Easter when after church and people come over, I do the Easter eggs, I hide the Easter eggs, and I'm responsible for making the wine punch. You know? And if I'm not there, you know, I couldn't say that part, but anyway, they were so well prepared that just attempt to negotiate brought on part B of what they had prepared. And that was the consequences if I continue to drink and don't do what they want. And my negotiation, I lightened up a little bit to asking for a whole week, and how about if I start tonight? And I did. I went back to work. That was good enough, you know. I got to go back to work. I got to have, my beer at lunch. And I got home, and I got permission to have one more drink. And if I knew that that was going to be the last one, it wouldn't have been one drink. You know, it wouldn't have. I go there, and one of the first things they have us do is a first step. Before you can get out of the detox area, you do a first step, and you present it to the other people that are also in that group, and there is where the program started to work. I didn't know that, but I was able to see in that first step that I wasn't drinking, I was no longer drinking because I liked it. I was drinking because I had to. I had another little lie going that kept me going, and that was, if it ever got bad enough, I can cut back or quit. I had never tested that one, you know? And then the third thing was, I always thought that it wasn't that bad, you know? That was the third thing, and that was what was keeping me going. I could admit that my life was unmanageable when I was drunk, but I had trouble with the other part of just my life being unmanageable. How am I doing on time?
You're doing great.
Yeah? Okay. My take on the first step, I could say I admit I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. I could say that. But what was going on in my head was, I am powerless over alcohol, and you guys' lives is unmanageable. Step two was similar, you know. I had no trouble believing in God. I believed that there is a God, and I also believe that God can do anything if God chooses to. Even restore me to sanity if it were necessary. That was the other problem. And I bring that up because what I think happens, what I know happened for me, and I think it happens for all of us if we're really attempting to do this, is we get a grace period, a period where we're stumbling along, kind of getting it, but not getting the whole thing. But I got to stay sober during that period while I was still getting it. About week three in that treatment place that was picked out for me, something wonderful happened, and that was I started doing this thing because I wanted it to work. And the reason was I was feeling that much better about myself. A third gift that I had gotten on three gifts I got on that day of the intervention were the open-mindedness, the willingness to do what they wanted to do, and then the one I didn't know was the hope that maybe this hell that I was in could be over, you know. And the start was admitting that that's where I was. And so I started doing it because I wanted it to work. And I got a sponsor.
His name was Bill Rayburn, and he passed on just last July. Wonderful man. We could have been friends a lot sooner because he went to the same church I did, but he couldn't drink. He was in AA, you know. But then when I found myself in the same boat, it was like, hey, Bill, would you be my sponsor? Geez, Rich, you know, I've been waiting for you, you know. What a wonderful start. You know, I have nothing but good things to say about sponsorship. He was, he was just this kind of sponsor that I needed and God picked him for me. He did things like, he gave me pop quizzes. You know, Rich, you say you're reading the book. Where does the term incomprehensible demoralization come from? What chapter? Just tell me the chapter. Da, 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 da. It got me to read the book. I made a deal with myself. I'm going to read the book. When I get home from a meeting, I get some ice cream and cookies or cake, if I read. Doesn't have to be, I can read a sentence or a paragraph or a page or a chapter, but I got to read and then I can get my dessert. I never ate desserts when I was drinking, you know? But you know what? Now I got a cake problem and a pie problem. The other thing Bill did for me was he asked me how many meetings I was planning to go to. He didn't tell me how many are you going to, and I had done my homework at the treatment deal, and part of the deal was a contract with yourself, and I was going to go to 4 meetings a week. I had gone through the schedule like they said, and I picked ones that I could go to and would go to, and it was 4. And I told him that, and he said, that sounds pretty good, but why don't you just go to a meeting a day? That way you won't have to keep track. You won't get confused. And so I said, okay, and it was just what I needed to do. I did a meeting a day for at least the first year. I still do a meeting a day for 6 days a week now. And it's a good thing. He's the guy that, at 6 months said, okay, it's time for you to start giving it back. Want you to go to an H&I meeting, hospitals and institutions, and I want you to, find a jail meeting to go to. And I go, wait a minute. How about if I start giving back in a place like where I got sober? And he said, what, you don't want to go to a jail? And I said, well, and he said, you're afraid to go to a jail? He said, well, and he said, why don't you do work furlough? That's not too scary. They don't lock you up and all that. So a month later, he said, what, are you signed up yet? And I said, well, I went to the meeting and I filled out the registration form. And he said, go to the next meeting, find a coordinator and get yourself in. And so I got myself into a meeting at work furlough down on 35th and Ocean View. And one of the greatest things that ever happened for me. I lasted 20 years doing that. Yeah, it was pretty darn good. And then the meeting just started. They changed the rules and guys could go out to meetings and the meeting population went down to 0 is what happened. The other thing that Bill did for me was at a year sober, he invited me to a Freedom Ranch annual dinner. Yeah, Freedom Ranch annual dinner. And so I went there with anyway, it was a real nice deal. We had a nice dinner, and then a couple months later he invites me and another guy, Willie, to a board meeting. So at the Freedom Ranch. And so Willie and I go there, and it's a complete railroad job. We leave there, and we're on the board. I'm still on the board. Can't get away from that one. I do want to say that Bill helped me through all the steps. He did not push me. He didn't push. But when I would start complaining about something, he would ask me what step I'm on. You know, he would do that. Anyway, what he did for me when I was about 8 years sober, I got notice that I was going to be laid off from the work that I had had. I made it through all of my drinking and into sobriety at this company. I had almost 24 years of sobriety, and here's what happened. They decided to lay me off, and they gave us a week of notice for every year of service plus another 2 weeks for everybody that was in this group. And that was a half a year of notice that I was going to get laid off. And I'm whining and crying to Bill about it. And he listens politely. And then when he's had enough, I think that's the way it came down, he says, Rich, while this is all going on, why don't you talk to your boss and see if you can come out to the ranch and do one of our groups? And then I think to myself, well, I got all this going on, and he wants me to go to the ranch and help do one of the classes out there. But that's what I thought. What I said was, okay. And I went to talk to my boss, and he's a cool guy. He knew I was in recovery. And he said, well, not every week, but how about every other week? So we picked a Thursday. So Thursday was the day for me to be able to go out to the ranch and do one of the groups. Well, it turns out it's this group that they call Big Book Stories. And so I start doing that group. And I don't think it took very long. It was maybe a couple months. And I started realizing that what Bill had me do didn't have anything to do with my problem. I was getting laid off, and that was moving right along. They were not set up to give me the reprieve that I, you know, thought was going to be coming. But what Bill had me do had everything to do with the solution. And that is, no matter what's going on in my life as an alcoholic, I need to pay attention to the most important thing, and that's me staying sober. And that was just one more thing to do in that regard. A good way to get out of myself for a whole, and then it was like a whole afternoon every other week. Things went, just the way the company had planned. I got laid off, and I thought, at least temporarily, I'm going to get to do this on a weekly basis. So I start going out to the ranch every Thursday now. And I'm still doing that. I still get to do that. Somewhere along the way, let me get my thoughts together here. Probably a year or so into doing this, one of the guys on staff asked if I could help him with his fourth and fifth step. And so I did. And I guess it went well enough for him that he recommended to, I guess that's the way it came down, he recommended that that I ought to be able to work with the residents when I'm out there on Thursday. And so one by one, guys, I don't know if they were encouraged to do it or what, but they'd come to me and ask if I could, you know, help them with their steps. And in a lot of cases, it was, here a fifth step. I would stay after the group. The group went from one to two, and I'd stay and I'd talk with a guy, and then I'd, you know, take off and go home or whatever. And once in a while it would last, and I'd stay until dinner. And then it started getting to where, like, there was a couple of guys a week that wanted to talk to me. So I would stay after dinner and talk with somebody. And then it just became full time, full on. I get out there and do the group, and then I get to talk to somebody, and maybe it's, I get to talk to one guy for the whole day and into the night. And sometimes I get to talk to, two, maybe three. I get home, and Jeannie will ask me, how many fists did you have today? Yeah. Only two. Only two. Occasionally it can be three if they move along fast, but going out there on a weekly basis is definitely one of the cornerstones of my sobriety. A building, I guess, is supposed to have one cornerstone. In this program, I got a handful, plus one, and we know what those cornerstones are. It's the meetings, and I know meetings don't keep me sober. What they do is when I'm in a meeting is helping me stay sober. That's for sure, because they're not serving anything. But what meetings really do is they remind me what it is I need to be doing. They remind me that I am who I am. I am what I am. I'm an alcoholic and I belong here. They remind me that there's a book, and if we use it, it provides some good answers to problems and direction. And I need to maintain this conscious contact with my higher power, and that I need to get out of myself and be of help to other people. That's a crucial one. That's not me. I belong at home. This is Saturday night, Now, I was not a bar drinker. I was just leave me alone and let me drinker, And I'm also kind of a penny pinch, or a pinch penny, whichever they, that goes. You get a lot more bang for your buck when you buy the big bottles, not when you buy the little glasses that the bartender gives you. That's where I belong. And Josh, hey, thanks for warming the folks up for us tonight. I could not think of spending a Saturday night out here, talking to a bunch of drunks, interestingly, I thought I was going to be pretty nervous up here. Because I was on the list to speak in April, and I was already getting nervous about that. Didn't have time to really get nervous on this one, but I remember telling my wonderful sponsor Bill that I was nervous in meetings about being called on, or I might make a mistake and raise my hand and speak, and that what I was doing in meetings, and by the way, I still do this to a degree, but I'd be rehearsing what it is I'm going to say, so you'd impress people, right? And he said, Rich, while when you get started in this mode of being nervous about talking or rehearsing what you're going to say, remember who it is you're trying to impress. It's a bunch of drunks. So it becomes a lot easier. I want to say a little bit about step three, because I had a hang up there too. Step three, I didn't understand it. It's really pretty clear. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I was trying, when I got to step three, I was trying to 100% totally turn my will and my life over to God. And I was not succeeding at that. And I knew that no matter how hard I tried, I would take my will back. I heard somebody say a couple of things that really helped me in that. And one of them is that the step doesn't say we did it. It says we made a decision to do it. And that's that old thing about, there's three frogs on the log. Two of them decided to jump off. How many are left? And it's one. Right? No, it's three. They just decided to. So what I had to come to terms with is that the step isn't asking me to do that. It's asking me to make a decision to do that. And then as you go through the rest of through the rest of the steps is when you fulfill, you know, carrying out that decision. That helped a lot. And the other thing about it is that somebody said, the step makes a lot more sense to me if I say God as I don't understand God. Now it's, which one is it? Oh, okay. Step three, and I kind of like the term as God as I don't understand God. Because if God is, and for me God is way bigger than I am able to understand. Way more. What I do need to do though is I need to understand what God can do for me. You know, a quick jump back to step two. The step says, that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Believing in God is one thing. Knowing that God will do that, can do that, is equally important. God does do that for me. One of the things that I do in the morning, and I started doing it from the time I wanted this thing to start working, and that is, I started asking God to help me not drink today. Real simple little prayer. God, help me to not drink today. And to the best of my knowledge, I've said that prayer every day since I decided I wanted this thing to work. And I've ended every day without taking a drink. I put those two things together. God can do that for me and does. 3 minutes? 4 minutes, okay. I want to talk a little bit about relationship. I said earlier on that I had a good relationship with my kids, but I also had a resentment going on about that, and that was when I was drinking. The kids would always go to their mom with the serious stuff. They could come to me with, can you help me with my homework? But they stopped doing that because they couldn't stand the way I helped them with homework. Can I get a ride and that kind of stuff? But they always went to mom with the important stuff, with the in the gut stuff. And fast forward, when I was at a year and 10 months sober, she decided to move on from the marriage. And the kids were with me. And I was programmed enough, I guess, that we just really started growing together. We just really, hit it off, and we were surviving, this breakup together, the Three Musketeer kind of deal. And what started happening was they started coming to me with this real serious stuff, regularly. And it got to the point where I didn't say it, but I would think to myself, geez, why don't you go to your mom with some of this stuff? One other thing, we talk about turning it over. After I recovered from that breakup, what's her name, leaving, I went through this recovery period. Bill helped me again. He got me in touch with a marriage and family counselor. And by the way, through the years, she has worked with me. She's worked with Jeannie. She worked with Pat. She worked with the boys. She knows the whole family. But I did what she said I had to do, and that was survive. And then I recovered. And then I was, I was alone. And I started looking for another her, And I got out the old hunting equipment, And And it didn't work, you know. It was frustrating. It was frustrating. And finally, one night, after going to another meeting for the wrong reason, I sat in the car at a park and had a little talk with God. And I said, God, I can't do this anymore. Let me be satisfied with what I have. I have my sobriety. I have the boys, the home, the job. Let me be satisfied with that. And you take this relationship thing. You take this. And when you think I'm ready, you can tell me. So I went to meetings for the right reason. Really got the relationship with the boys going and doing well at work, the whole thing. And then, one Friday night, a meeting after the meeting, Carl's Jr. at the corner of, Claremont Drive and Bergener. I go to the meeting after the meeting. Jeannie goes to the meeting after the meeting. We hadn't met yet, you know, and we met. And over a period of time, we just kept meeting at Carl's Jr., you know, and we started closing the place, you know. And then it finally, you know, duh, you know, it finally dawned on me that God was telling me that I was ready, you know. I stuck up with, you know, my side of the deal. I turned it over to Him. And I left it with Him and honored that. And He honored His side of it and put Jeannie in my life. And I got to tell somebody today that when Jeannie and I got married, and by the way, we're going to be 20 years on, get this, February 29th. We are going to have, you know, 20 years of marriage, but it'll be our, fifth anniversary, right? He gave Jeannie to Rich. And God in His mercy gave Rich to Jeannie. And I buy that, you know. That's just what happened. Some people will kind of, you know, watch out for, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus. I'm here to say, it's a good thing. When we did get together, Jeannie got to keep doing the program she was doing. And I got to keep doing the program I was doing. And we, you know, we got together, but we kept our, you know, what we were doing in recovery, the way it was working for us. And, you know, over time it's come together, you know, like we get to come to a Saturday night meeting together and a Tuesday night meeting together, but she has her meetings. I have my meetings. We keep doing that. But one of the wonderful things is to have another person in the home in recovery. And know why we're doing what we're doing, understanding, you know, that we're doing this for ourselves and for each other. And, Larry, thanks for, dropping this little bomb on me and sharing this. And, it was good for me. Thank you very much.